Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is special team coverage on News 104.5 WOKV. Now here's your host, John Engel.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on this Monday evening. It is 6:10 here on News 104.5 WOKV. Thanks for joining us. We have been following this federal fraud trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown step by step, and now we are at the point where deliberations have begun. They are paused for the time being. We'll pick up tomorrow morning. We'll get into that a little further in this special edition of Jacksonville's Evening News. I'm joined in studio by WOKV's political analyst Rick Mullaney, and we have Stephanie Brown still down at the courthouse where she has spent the better part of her last 2 weeks, it seems, piecing through all of the big moments of this trial. And now it's starting to come to the waning moments of this trial. Stephanie, I know you're down on the line. What were some of those big takeaways earlier today? I know closing arguments, a big focus this morning.
That's right. Closing arguments really needed to seal the deal for both of these sides. You know, one of the questions that's continued to pop up throughout this entire process has been why Brown's chief of staff, Ronnie Simmons, would have acted to deposit money into her account from this bogus charity if she were not telling him to. If you're just starting to catch up with this trial, to bring you the very basics, Brown, her chief of staff, Ronnie Simmons, and a third person, Carla Wiley, are accused of raising money for this bogus charity, One Door for Education, and ultimately using that money for their personal expenses instead, saying One Door was never actually a registered nonprofit. So prosecutors have continually said Ronnie Simmons withdrew money from One Door Education's bank account. He then deposited money into the bank account of Brown, and Simmons has pleaded guilty to doing that. He says that she directed her to do it, that she directed him to do it, and prosecutors say, why else would he do it? Well, today, during the closing argument, is when the defense laid out their reason. They said that prosecutors have never really effectively shown whether Simmons had access to Brown's personal bank account or personal checks in addition to the One Door money. So it's possible that maybe he was stealing from Brown directly, and as a result, he would take money from One Door and put it into her bank account to prevent her account from getting overdrawn and alerting people to his fraud. Now, prosecutors were quick to follow up with that, saying, why would he steal from Brown and then steal from One Door to cover it up? Why wouldn't he just steal from Brown? So I guess to bring in our political analyst, Rick Mullaney, at this point, I mean, that certainly sounds like a complex scheme. Is that a lot to be bringing in at this stage in the game?
A lot of times on the defense side, what you really want, remember this, if it gets confusing, if it gets convoluted, a lot of times that becomes the equivalent of reasonable doubt. And if they can muddy it up some, if they can confuse it some, that actually works to their benefit some. What you just described was hard to follow in and of itself. And if I'm the prosecutor, I step back and say, wait a second. Don't overcomplicate this. This is very, very simple. This money went into the account. She spent it for her own benefit. She received hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then you try to simplify the case. The burden on the prosecution, I say, is not just the burden of proof. It's the burden of clarity. The burden of clarity is with the prosecution. On the defense side, if they can create confusion, that's often the equivalent of reasonable doubt.
And Rick, we were talking before we came on air on this special edition of Jacksonville's Evening News, too. The sheer size of the counts in this indictment kind of provides that advantage a little bit to the defense as well. You talk about muddying the waters and making it difficult to prove without a reasonable doubt that she is guilty.
It is. Remember, you have 22 counts. You have 12 jurors. Unlike state court, in state court, it's typically six jurors. There are only two cases in state court in which you have 12 jurors. One is a death penalty case. The other is for eminent domain, if they're going to take your life or your property in state court. But in federal court, it has to be unanimous verdict. 22 counts. Some of them sound intimidating of themselves, conspiracy counts and mail fraud and tax fraud. So for the jury, it's a very big task. From the prosecution, it is as important to the prosecution to be clear, simple, and direct as it is to be correct on all of this. From the defense side, they can make an argument. It still has to have common sense. It needs to be compelling. But they can afford to muddy the waters, because oftentimes that will help them in the deliberations with the jurors.
And again, Rick Mullaney, director of the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute. He also moonlights as the WOKV political analyst. But that's his day job, and that's why we bring him in. He's such a good resource to have in here. Also, counsel, you've been in these courtrooms before. You've gone through the process of a trial and are familiar with this much more than at least I am. And I know Stephanie Brown, sitting in that courtroom, has been picking at all these details and keeping us informed. How big is a closing argument for each of these sides? We talk about the substance with Stephanie Brown and how they both kind of had that boilerplate of what they were trying to get across in that last message to the jury. But how important is it for each, the defense and prosecution, in closing arguments?
It's very, very important. I was a state court prosecutor for 10 years under Ed Austin. I was not a federal prosecutor. But whether you're in state court or federal court, having that last word with the jury and that closing arguments are very important. As a prosecutor, I never liked it when you had a whole weekend before you gave your closing arguments. As a prosecutor, I never liked it when deliberations went into the next day. I always believed I wanted to keep the evidence fresh in front of the jury. I wanted it to move along. As time goes on, I was always concerned that jurors might forget evidence. I tend to think sometimes we think that the big closing argument is going to persuade them. It can be overwhelming. More typically, it's important to really know what this evidence felt like to the, how did the jurors see this evidence during all these days of testimony? Some very compelling evidence on the forensic side with accounting, some very significant testimony. Your closing argument tends to be only as good as what you've built during that trial. You can sound eloquent and it cannot connect with juries, and sometimes you can be stumbling but connecting because you're tying it to something that makes sense. So today's arguments were very, very important, but be careful and put them in the context of the overall prosecution.
And Stephanie, a last thought on this too. We rely on you for our sights and sounds from inside the courtroom, because it is closed off. We can't be tweeting. We only rely on your emails once you get a slight break in the action. Did you sense any emotion from being in there? Was there any moments to grab onto in closing arguments, or did it feel more formulaic?
Well, you know, you just heard Rick talking about all of the forensic evidence and the numbers, and we know that the jury has been really bogged down with a lot of these very technical elements. But what we also saw with the closing arguments today was trying to paint a very relatable and simple human picture. So it wasn't overt emotion necessarily, because these were the attorneys that were presenting the closing arguments, as opposed to, say, Brown testifying herself, which we saw just a couple of days ago. But for her defense, you know, the image that they tried to paint was one that they really wanted the jury to understand and empathize and potentially even sympathize with. They portrayed her as somebody who had been taken advantage of by this person that she grew to trust with all of her finances, all of her affairs, and ultimately pointing out that she was aging and relied increasingly on her staff. For prosecutors, they painted a very different picture, one of a shrewd politician who had held her seat for more than two decades, one who knew exactly what she was doing and was directing those around her to fall in line, and ultimately, as prosecutors also said, a person who somebody just does not say no to.
And Stephanie, when we come back, we're going to continue to piece through all of these big developments. As we had closing arguments, we also had jury deliberation, began today, but it is continuing. We'll look ahead to tomorrow and some of the intricacies that go on for the attorneys on each side, the defense and the prosecution. We'll lean on Rick for that. For Rick and Stephanie, I'm John Engel. We will be back as a special edition of Jacksonville's Evening News continues.
Arguments have been made. Now the federal fraud trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown is in the hands of the jury. This is special team coverage on News 104.5 WOKV. Now here's your host, John Engel.
Welcome back. We're so happy you joined us tonight. Verdict watch is on in this federal fraud trial of now former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. The jury sent home for the day, but still a lot to get to, and we'll piece through that with our Stephanie Brown downtown at the courthouse. I'm also joined in studio by the director of the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute and WOKV political analyst Rick Mullaney. You decide which title bears more importance. But Stephanie, a lot going on. Obviously, we touched on closing arguments last segment, but the jury also had a lot on its plate today.
That's right. It was just around 1:13 p.m., you know, to be approximate, that the jury actually was sent into their deliberation room to take over this case once and for all. They went on for about 3.5 hours, and then around 5 p.m., they said they were ready to call it for the day, so that's when deliberations wrapped up. Now, typically, you would start to get maybe some questions from jurors as they start to piece things together. We didn't hear anything today after deliberations formally resumed. And I can tell you, I was closely watching all of them throughout the closing arguments that were presented this morning, and it seemed like they were paying pretty close attention to what the attorneys were saying. Many of them were actually even taking notes, but not letting off much emotionally in terms of what they may be thinking. They weren't really broadcasting that in their face, so they have a lot of really good poker faces on this jury specifically. You know, as we start to now look into what will be day two tomorrow, starting at 9 a.m., bringing in WOKV political analyst Rick Mullaney. You know, as an attorney, are you starting to think as the hours continue to tick by that, you know, the case is going for or against you just surely for that reason?
I think most lawyers tend to get worried regardless, but I would caution against reading too much into jury deliberations at all. I mean, as a prosecutor, you want a conviction right away. As a defense lawyer, you want an acquittal right away. But the truth is, you try to read into a jury question or you try to read into how long they've been out. And for too many years, we were all wrong on what the jury was going to do next. You never know whether there's an individual juror, for example, who may be holding out, and they can be holding out in either direction, for acquittal or for conviction. You never know what the sense of the jury is. So I do think there's a tendency on both sides, the prosecution and the defense, to read something into how long a jury has been out or to read a lot into a particular question they may ask. And sometimes from a question, you might get a little bit of an insight into what the deliberations are. But I would caution the listeners against trying to read anything into the fact that they went home for the day.
Well, you've made your case at this point, right? There's nothing you can change. It's just human nature to get a little nervous.
That's exactly right. And you try to, at this point, and John, your point's well taken, both the prosecution and the defense will put a good face on it. They have made their case. They want to be prepared in case they have to answer a question and to make recommendations to the judge, because the judge will ask them about how to respond to a particular question, or he potentially could, so you want to be prepared. But the truth of the matter is, you're just going to sit around and wait till the jury comes back with their verdict. And you don't want to read too much into how long they're out.
Now, Stephanie, anything in particular from the judge when things were reconvened? Any notes from the jury? Did we get anything during their deliberations today?
So we didn't get anything directly from their deliberations today. It was about 3.5 hours, and we just sat in the courtroom waiting. In addition to the media, there was, I'd say, about a dozen other people who I've seen in and out of the trial so far, just milling around and waiting to see if there was any news. Actually, the brief moment of levity came at one point. Brown's attorney walked into the courtroom, and a few of the people, the trial watchers, kind of went up to him, "Have you heard something?" And he turned around, he's like, "Oh, no, I'm just here for the Wi-Fi." You know, they're trying to have a little bit of fun, or at least keep it a little bit light in this time. But, you know, the end of the day, the judge, while he's been more than relatable and kind with the jury the whole time, even joking about the fact that they apparently didn't have quite enough pizza for lunch today, but he
There's
made one thing
pizza,
very clear in a polite but stern way, is that their deliberations were over as soon as they left that courtroom. You know, the jury has been leaving every day with the specific instruction of don't talk about this case to anyone, don't talk, don't consume media. But after you get the conversation going, obviously it's easy to see how maybe they think they can continue it, walking in the hallway, walking in the elevator, whatever the case may be. But the judge made it clear at 5:01 p.m., when they left that courtroom, their deliberations were done, and they were not to pick it back up, John, until 9 a.m. tomorrow.
And Rick, as we have about a minute to wrap up here, I know this isn't enough time to go through the entire dynamics of how much this case means for Jacksonville and just for the relationship that the average citizens have with their politicians and their representatives, but where do you put a conviction or acquittal in the grand scheme of Jacksonville history and this dynamic with Corrine Brown?
Well, we'll be talking about this in the days ahead, but I will say this. This is one of the most significant public corruption prosecutions in Jacksonville since consolidation in 1968. That's half a century. And Jacksonville had a big wave of public corruption conviction prosecutions in the 60s. We had another wave in the 1930s. But this case itself is one of the most significant, and it will be much talked about and much discussed. A high-stakes prosecution, a lot at stake. Corrine Brown in the public sector for more than 30 years, 10 years in the legislature, 24 years in Congress. So this case we talked about a great deal, and I think it's very significant.
Again, a huge thanks to Rick Mullaney for joining us, the WOKV political analyst and director of the JU Public Policy Institute. We're so happy you could come by. I think he's going to join us later on in this trial. We at least hope so. I'm John Engel for Stephanie Brown. We thank you so much for tuning in to a special edition of Jacksonville's Evening News.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.